This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield. The death of Muhammad Ali a week ago has inspired the telling and retelling of stories about him, many of them familiar. Unlikely as it may seem, given that Ali had been perhaps the most recognizable and written about athlete of his or any time, we turned up one story with which nobody here at Only a Game was familiar, and we found just the right man to tell it. On January 19, 1981, Bruce Haggerty, then a police sergeant in Los Angeles, was called to an office building on Wilshire Boulevard. A man had climbed out a ninth-floor window onto a ledge, and he was threatening to jump. As Sergeant Haggerty went about doing the job he'd been trained to do, he couldn't have known he was about to get some very high-powered assistance.
Well, we got a call about a jumper, a man threatening to jump from the ninth floor of the Miracle Mile office building in Los Angeles. I was the field sergeant at the time for LAPD, responded. There's all kinds of protocols we go through, set up a perimeter, get officers up there to talk to the person. We got behavioral sciences up there with some psychologists. I think there was even a minister up there. All of those resources tried to talk the man back inside the building, and nothing was working. He got pretty nasty down below. There was a crowd of 200-300 people. And this is in the Wilshire district, so people that don't know L.A., this is like right in the city. They were chanting, jump, jump. So it got kind of tense, and it was awful. They're wanting them, but they got to jump, and so they were kind of encouraging him. So that brought a whole different dynamic. We had to bring in other officers to move the crowd out, because certainly we didn't want that to happen. The man was agitated and not being reasonable, and you know you can't reason with unreasonable people, so we were concerned that he may in fact jump. We saw Rolls Royce drive up, and I don't know if it was the driver or an aide came over and asked the officers if they could talk to the person in charge. And so I said, sure, brought in. And they said, I have Muhammad Ali in the car. He would like to help. He'd like to actually go up and talk to the man and see if he can talk him out. So I said, well, let me talk to him. And so Muhammad Ali came out and shook my hand, and we talked a little bit. Made kind of a game plan and some kind of rules and engagements. You know, we didn't want him to grab the guy or do any of that kind of stuff. So he went on up there and talked to the man and kept him in conversation for some time. Couldn't hear it because he was, you know, up on the ninth floor and I was down on the street. But, you know, you just wondered, is this going to work? And is this guy suddenly going to jump? He was kind of the last resort. I didn't have any more tools in my toolbox. And he was kind of a gift. What Ali did was he connected with the man, I think. He also said he would help him and that he loved him and that he didn't want the man to end his life. So the man decided to take him up on it and came back into the building. I think the man was enamored with a man of Ali's stature that would take the time to come up and talk to him. And, of course, he offered him some things that we couldn't offer him. When they came down, Ali said that he had promised the man a ride in his Rolls Royce. So Ali asked if I told him, I said, we have to bring him to the police station. He says, well, can he ride in my car? And I says, yeah, he can, as long as we have a police officer in the car as well. And so we put Ali and the subject and a police officer in the Rolls Royce, and they drove to Wilshire Station and came on inside, and then we actually turned it over to behavioral sciences. I believe they took him to the Veterans Hospital. And so I have no idea what happened after that, nor did I hear anything about what happened. So it was kind of a day on the job, and then you go to the next thing. Ali treated us with respect. He treated this young man with respect. And so I was very impressed with what a gentleman and really a gentle soul that he is. For a guy that's a world boxing champ, you might think he might be a little gruff, but he was not. He's a very nice, gentle man. There was a movie producer in L.A. that called me last year about this, and he wanted to try to do a little TV deal on it, but we couldn't find any information. Nobody really knows what the guy's real name was. According to the news article, his name was Joe, but no last name and no record of what happened after that. So it is what it is in the way we're telling it. And a lot of times people ask me, says, hey, tell me a story, so I'll tell them that story. But that was certainly not a normal day in the life of a police sergeant in LAPD.
The Los Angeles Times chronicled the story of Ali's heroics in an article published on January 21, 1981. Photographer Boris Yarrow and staff writer Lee Harris contributed to the original reporting. Our story was produced by Alex Schroeder. Gordie Howe was an athlete who died old. He was 88 when he passed on Friday. He was also an athlete who played old, and then he played some more. Though by the time he teamed with his two sons for six seasons in the World Hockey Association, his career with the NHL Red Wings had long since assured him of a position in hockey's Hall of Fame. Howe was a powerful offensive force, and his offense wasn't limited to shooting the puck. He was the embodiment of old-timey hockey, which is perhaps why Bobby Orr and Wayne Gretzky are among those who've said Howe was the best ever. Maybe they were concerned that if they didn't say that, Howe would track them down and elbow them into submission. Pro hockey is no country for old men, but nobody who valued his teeth told Gordie Howe that. He played for 32 of the winters from 1946 until 1980. At 45 years old, he was the most valuable player in the WHA. Decades earlier in the NHL, he'd played on four Stanley Cup winners and accumulated a shelf full of MVP trophies. He led the league in points six times. There's going to be a bridge named after him in Detroit, which probably would have pleased him, but not as much as the distinction that was coined for him years ago. It's called the Howe Hat Trick. Whereas a normal hat trick means a player scores three goals in a game, the Howe hat trick requires a goal, an assist, and a fight. Off the ice, Howe was known as a prince of a guy, always happy to sign autographs and chat with his fans. He had a sense of humor, too. He referred to the last few years of his career as, quote, poetry in slow motion. He was also known as Mr. Hockey, and he was no dope. He had a copyright on the name. Time to talk about the election. No, don't turn off the program. I don't mean that election about which you've been hearing too much. I have another election in mind and another candidate.
I believe there will be a movement to ban high school football.
That's Russell Davis. He's running for a position on the Board of Trustees of the Clark County School District in Nevada, the fifth largest in the country. And he doesn't just believe there will be a movement to ban high school football. He's made eliminating the sport at high schools in Clark County a campaign promise.
I'm running on a platform to protect our kids from head injuries. And part of the main component of that platform would be to ban high school football. We do not have an airbag between our brain and the skull. And when you get hit, it moves.
For the record, the remaining planks in Mr. Davis's platform are not down with old glory and Cuba's got it right. In fact, he used to be a fan of the great American tradition of high school football.
Well, I grew up in a small town of Gardnerville up in northern Nevada, and that was Friday night. Friday night during the fall was football season, and we all went down to watch the game. And so it is part of a tradition. I don't think it's as big as it is in Texas. We're not spending $62 million on a new high school football stadium. But my thing is traditions come and go. Why don't we have boxing anymore in high school?
A rhetorical question, if there ever was one, I suppose. Obviously, Russell Davis's point is that young men should not be getting their brains bounced around in their heads under the auspices of activities at the public schools they attend. There are 49 high schools in his district, and at least according to what anecdotal evidence he's been able to compile, Davis is not alone in his conviction.
I did a call-in show the other day, and, you know, out of the five people that were able to call in during the time that I was on, three of them supported my position on it.
It's a landslide.
That's what I'm saying. All I need is, you know, it's a majority. I'm good with that.
Spoken like a politician. But what makes candidate Davis think those three of five callers can be representative of the electorate in Clark County?
Once they get past that emotion, then I think they really sit down and they go, you know what, you're right.
According to some of the Facebook posts responding to Davis's candidacy, getting past the emotion won't be easy. Among the more restrained of those posts goes like this.
The positives I got from playing high school and college football far outweigh the two concussions I had.
Here's another one.
I'm waiting for the day when kids have to stand completely still with no physical contact with other students whatsoever.
Parents who are emotionally invested in the high school football careers of their sons may be similarly disinclined to transcend emotion. Maybe the two dissenters who called that radio show felt that way, too, or maybe they were concerned with the rest of Davis's platform, which includes higher pay for teachers, smaller classes, mandatory personal finance classes, and healthier school lunches. But probably not. Davis is well aware that it's his position on high school football that distinguishes him from the school board candidates around the country who want more bake sales or fewer references to evolution. He knows the revelations about chronic traumatic encephalopathy have inspired doubts about football at all levels. But though the President of the United States himself has said that if he had sons, they wouldn't play football, that's not a popular stance in the land where the NFL is king, which is part of the reason Russell Davis makes a distinction between football as played at public high schools and the game the big kids play.
I grew up a big fan of the Raiders, and there's talk of the Raiders coming to Las Vegas, and I'm excited about that. But these are adults, and as an adult, you can measure your decision based on the risk versus the reward. I'm talking about kids.
Of course, if the kids stop playing in high school, the pool of potential college players will shrink dramatically, as will the pool from which the NFL picks those fellows allegedly capable of measuring risk against reward. But that's not something Russell Davis is concerned with right now. He's got an election to win next week, and as soon as the Clark County returns are in, we'll let you know whether Mr. Davis has a new job. There's more Only a Game coming right up, and while you're enjoying the show, I thought I'd mention that our podcast is available for download 24/7 on iTunes or Stitcher, so you can listen anytime you'd like to. And you can share your comments about Only a Game and rate us. That way other podcasters will know we're available for the podcasting. That's the way you say it, right? I'm Bill Littlefield. Among this week's three stories you should know is one with which you're probably already much too familiar, but we can't leave it out. My guests are Rachel Bachman of the Wall Street Journal and Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports. Welcome back to both of you.
It's good to be here.
Thanks, Bill.
All right, my story is first. This week, former Stanford student Brock Turner, who had been convicted of sexually assaulting an unconscious woman on the Stanford campus in 2015, was sentenced to 6 months in prison and probation. Turner's attorney, the probation officer, and the judge all referred to Turner's accomplishments as a swimmer. And apparently the assumption all around was that because Turner forfeited great opportunities as an athlete when he committed and was convicted of the felonies that we're talking about, he's already suffered significant punishment. If the victim had been a potentially great athlete whose career was delayed or compromised or ruined because Turner raped her, would Turner's sentence have been longer, I wonder? Based on the reactions of the sentencing, which have been all over the internet, I know I'm not the only person who thinks that considering a man's athletic prowess and potential when deciding how long he should be incarcerated for sexually assaulting an unconscious woman is insane, criminally insane, maybe. There's a campaign to encourage Congress to pass a law to strengthen efforts to combat sexual violence on college campuses. This week's news about the sentencing of Brock Turner makes me wonder if maybe that is something that's absolutely necessary. I don't know how else this should be addressed.
Well, one of the remarkable things about this absolutely despicable
scenario is that this case had not one but two witnesses, which is almost unheard of in a sexual assault case. So it was even more shocking that the punishment was so lenient. I think anything you can do legally or otherwise to make sure that the proper punishment is meted out would be the right thing to do.
This is what we do in our society. We got up these athletes. We got up their accomplishments. And they're wonderful entertainers, and it's inspiring to see human performance pressed to its limit. But at some point, it is just a sport. It is only a game. And it shouldn't have any bearing on a sexual assault case. I mean, period. There's no debate. And like Rachel said, this is a case. This was like as close to an open and shut sexual assault case as you will ever find, and still get 6 months. Think about what that means. If you are a victim of sexual assault and you look at this campus adjudication system that's a giant mess, but now you look to real law enforcement, it's no wonder so many sexual assaults never go reported.
Many women are discouraged from even coming forward, particularly in cases where they're accusing athletes, because they are often abused again on social media and in the court of public opinion. And so that just underscores the disappointment that a lot of people are feeling about how this case turned out.
Patrick, this is perhaps an impossible corner to turn, but we need to turn the corner anyway. I understand that you've been paying attention to the Atlanta Braves, who have been terrible on the field this season, and the bad news does not end on the field, right?
No, it doesn't. I mean, so my story involves the new baseball stadium being built for the team. It's out in the suburbs of Cobb County. And this week we found out back in 2008, residents of that county voted for $40 million of new parks. You know, not ballparks to enrich billionaire owners and millionaire players, just public parks to enrich the rest of us. But it turns out the money for that is now being siphoned off to help pay for this new baseball stadium. And if those people want their parks, they're going to have to raise their taxes. A 5-person local commission approved this deal without any public debate. They got around open meeting laws by standing in hallways. And all of this is happening to replace a current ballpark that is all of 20 years old. Now, here's the really bad news. There's worse fiascos going on just right now. Glendale, Arizona, they've paid $300 million plus for a hockey team that's going to leave town anyway. I could go on. This isn't a congressional filibuster. But the takeaway here is that cities never seem to learn. And even when they do, and I do think public opinion is turning slowly against these massive corporate welfare projects, politicians find way to pass this stuff anyway.
But I think in a lot of cases, in a lot of cities, fans are complicit. The late, great Hubert Humphrey from my home state of Minnesota said, without the Minnesota Vikings, we'd be a cold Omaha. And I think that is a constant fear in various states and cities, that if we lose our major league franchises, we will be lesser than. And sure enough, right now, construction of a new Minnesota Vikings stadium is nearing its end. Guess what? Half of it was publicly funded.
Talk to any economist who's ever studied this. If you're looking to stimulate your local economy, they will tell you you are literally better off dropping cash from helicopters and airplanes over the downtown than building a stadium.
All right, Rachel, I hear that your story involves hamster wheels and power drills and puppies as well, and I'm very much in favor of puppies, so please explain.
Yes, well, this all has to do with corporate step challenges and their increasing popularity as companies try to keep their health insurance costs down by encouraging their workers to move more. And so these contests get people to see who can take the most steps in a few weeks or months. There's just one problem with them. They can be cheated. In fact, in some cases, people are cheating with no money on the line. The people I spoke with and the companies I spoke with who operate these challenges said they've seen everything from people attaching their Fitbits or activity trackers to ceiling fans to rack up all kinds of overnight activity to hamster wheels, as you mentioned. To their favorite schnauzer or black lab.
Right. The puppy has no objection at all to running with a Fitbit on his paw, I'm sure.
Absolutely not. These things are very light, very easy to use. You know, I spoke with one guy, one of the few, who was brave enough to admit he had cheated. And he attached his Fitbit to a power saw and 5 hours later, voila, 57,000 steps richer.
First of all, who would imagine cheating in corporate America? That's never happened. And secondly, of course people are cheating. This is like human nature. It's not just an American thing. I mean, if you look at like amateur cycling and stuff, people take steroids in that to win races where they pay to enter the race. There's not even prize money.
Rachel, did you come away from your investigation of this story feeling worse or better about human nature?
I have to say, Bill, in some ways I felt better because people were so incredibly creative in the ways they tried to cheat. They weren't necessarily good at it, but they showed incredible ingenuity, and there really is nothing more American than that.
My guests for Three Stories You Should Know have been Rachel Bachman of The Wall Street Journal and Patrick Ruby of Vice Sports. Thank you, both of you.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Bill.
Straight down the middle, it went straight down the middle.
Some say that this song is the first ever written about the game of golf. It was composed for the 1948 movie Honor Caddy, starring Bob Hope and Bing Crosby. Crosby's the guy whose voice would make the song famous. It seems unlikely that Straight Down the Middle is really the first song ever written about golf. Golf's been played since the mid-15th century, and countless odes, arias, and ditties must have been written and lost over the course of time. But what is clear is that Bing Crosby, the best-selling recording artist of the 20th century, was a big fan of golf. His son Nathaniel Crosby starts our story there in his own words.
I think he really caught the bug in his college years at Gonzaga. His Rhythm Boys partner, Al Rinker, was his golfing buddy. When he quit his law clerk job and ventured for Hollywood stardom, he and Al Rinker left with a drum set and a bag of golf clubs in the back of their jalopy, made their way from Spokane to Los Angeles. He budgeted time. It was his foremost thought when he woke up in the morning is how he was going to carve it into his schedule. And his radio shows were the first tape-delayed broadcasts. That, of course, was so that he could get on the golf course more often.
This is Ken Carpenter, welcome you to the Bing Crosby Show for Chesterfield. Produced and transcribed in Hollywood with John Scott Trotter and his orchestra, Judd Collins with the Bears, and Bing's guests, Louis Armstrong and Ella Fitzgerald.
And the next thing you know, it was Clark Gable and Lucille Ball and Jimmy Durante and Oliver Hardy and all of these guys hanging out at the Lakeside Golf Club, you know, 9 or 18 holes in the afternoon between their work gigs. I was the youngest son from the second generation, so he was 58 years old when I was born, which is a little bit older than I am now. And the idea of having more children or another litter with me being 54 is just incomprehensible. So Dad had an incredible amount of stamina and energy. Life has been a downward spiral for me because I was born into digs that included a 30,000-foot house. So at any rate, we had a 5-acre estate and had a big, big backyard. Dad filled in the pool, which made for a nice chipping area. And I used that backyard to hit balls at age 3 with plastic balls first. Dad would be out there. He was fighting the shanks in his later years, which is a horrifying metal affliction where you hit the ball off the neck of the club no matter what you do. So he'd be in the backyard with me, chipping around the house for hours on end. He let my brother, who's 3 years older, play with him at the Burlingame Country Club when my brother turned, oh, I'd say 9 or 10. So my immediate goal at that point was to get good enough to play at the Burlingame Country Club with my dad and my brother. I probably made it to the big course when I was about 8 or 9. Then it became a goal to be better than my brother at anything. So I chose golf because he was basically a better everything else than I was. So I focused on golf and, you know, not only was able to play with my dad, but I think I went from about an 18 handicap to a 4 handicap when I was just about turning 12. And at that point, my dad, you know, couldn't play enough golf with me. He just loved it. He sang so many love songs but never did he sing a song that said, "I love you" in the song. And the one song that was written for him was Moonlight Becomes You. And in one of the phrases, it says, "If I say I love you, I want you to know it's not just because there's moonlight, although moonlight becomes you so. I'm not going to sing for you."
If I say I love you, I want you to know it's not just because there's moonlight, although moonlight becomes you so.
You know, when you've got your songwriters basically avoiding the term "I love you" in their lyrics, you can grow to expect that you're not going to hear "I love you," but it's something that you always knew. You knew he did. The first day that I beat my brother was the first day that I beat my dad, and I think it was that summer when I was 13, and I think I shot an 82 or something, and my brother had had a bad day and shot an 84, and my dad had just had surgery about 6 months earlier, had a lung operation. Dad said that the injury disqualified it as being a real event. You know, he maintained a 4 handicap until he was 70, and then the surgery happened, and he probably slipped to about a 10 or 12 handicap after that. I was extremely motivated to try to become the next Jack Nicklaus. You know, everybody referred to me and my brother as the son of Bing Crosby growing up, and that can wear on a kid who's trying to find his own identity. So I think that there was a burning desire to kind of cut my own cloth and make a name for myself. Well, I was lucky enough to win my first club championship at the Burlingame Country Club when I was 15 years old. Dad was still alive for that, so he came home that night and told my mom that it was the happiest day of his life. You know, she was like, excuse me, you know who you're talking to. You're not talking about the birth of your children. You're not talking about our wedding day. You're talking about today. At any rate, he was able to watch me play in some junior tournaments, and no matter how he tried to disguise himself, he would nevertheless pick up 8 or 10 people who figured out who he was, and he was always concerned that that would be a distraction for my performance. So he would literally watch me from a hole away and have his binoculars out. I didn't know he was even watching me until he said, you know, "I saw you used a wedge from off the green. Why didn't you use a straight-faced club?" You know, I'm like, "Dad, where were you?" I was like, "Oh, I was watching you." Dad died doing what he loved to do. He putted out, shooting an 82, I think. And on the way back to the clubhouse, died, you know, after finishing his 18th hole, which is better than finishing your life in a nursing home. His life was cut short when I was just turning 16 years old. I was actually the favorite to win the U.S. Junior because I'd qualified by beating the field by 7 shots. And I was so focused on winning that U.S. Junior for my dad, and then it didn't happen. But I basically held on to that motivation and, you know, the bigger tournament with the U.S. Amateur a year and a half later. And I came from behind in my last couple of matches. I was 3 down and 4 down. And, you know, it would have been great for him to be around. I always like to, you know, make the comment that he had a better view than anybody in the gallery that day. Perhaps him being on the other side of the universe might have helped sneak that last putt in the corner of the cup. At the time, I think it was the second youngest player to ever win the U.S. Amateur. I think he would have been extremely proud, and I think he would have said, "Don't let it go to your head, son." He wanted success for all of his children, but I think maintaining a level head was what was most important to him. I played 3 years on the European Tour when I finally did turn pro. I was, as they say, negative trending. I think I was 87th on the money list my freshman year, which was 2nd out of the rookie class. And then I was 115th the next year and 155th. It was early retirement for my golfing career at age 26. I like to say that I made my retirement announcement in front of my girlfriend and my Labrador. Golf is such a great technique to become close to your kids, which I've carried on to my generation and my children. When my son beat me for the first time, I was like the great Santini and Robert Duvall. I went to the practice range and practiced all the way an hour past dusk. But as time would always dictate, my son now beats me with regularity and just collected his first club championship, winning the Bears Club Championship, where Jack Nicklaus and others hang out. So we're very proud of Nathaniel Jr. at this point.
Nathaniel Crosby's new book is called 18 Holes with Bing, Golf, Life, and Lessons from Dad. Our story was produced by Karen Given. We'll be right back with more sports NPR style. In the meantime, I thought you'd like to know that next week we'll explore sports origins. We'll start at or near the beginning. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, just what is an amateur? Anyway, we ask some amateurs who might also be professionals what they think. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for our look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Here we go.
6 months ago, nobody who didn't live in Pittsburgh was predicting that the Penguins would win the Stanley Cup, but they're up 3-2 in the finals. Are you going to tell me now you knew all along they'd win it all?
Absolutely not. I mean, this is a tremendous surprise. It's also sort of the final coming out party for Sidney Crosby, who is a dominant player in the league.
The Golden State Warriors, currently competing in the NBA Finals, set the regular season record for wins with 73 of them, Charlie. Magic Johnson, for one, was apparently not impressed. He said this week that his so-called Showtime Lakers would have beaten this year's Warriors. Is he right?
Yes, he is right. Those Lakers could do everything that Cleveland did to beat the Warriors, except the Lakers did it better and with better players.
The NBA refs have a beef with Commissioner Adam Silver. They don't like the league's so-called last 2 minute reports policy that provides for reviews of calls made during the final 2 minutes of games. The commissioner has said that fans are entitled to this because they want, quote, transparency. Does Mr. Silver have a point?
Yeah, because, I mean, the obvious precipitating incidents were all the game-deciding or quasi-game-deciding calls in the playoffs. It's long been an accurate thing to say that the officiating in the NBA gets a lot different in the last 2 minutes of a game. So I think if they're actually studying that, that's good.
This week, it was announced that average per-game attendance at NCAA men's basketball games had dropped by 25 people per game. So I'm sure that there are many executives at the NCAA running from office to office trying to figure out how to fix that.
Well, I'm sure once they find those 25, you know, once they find those, whoever those 25 people are, the NCAA will discipline them.
I don't think they can discipline fans yet.
They can try, believe me.
Giants pitcher Madison Bumgarner is a three-time All-Star. He's won 18 games in each of the last couple of seasons. He's got some World Series jewelry as well. And now he wants to participate in the Home Run Derby at the All-Star game. Giants manager Bruce Bochy isn't sure that's a good idea. What do you think?
I think it's a great idea. And I think if baseball didn't have so many sticks and so much mud, everybody else would think it was a good idea, too. Give him a shot. Why not? I mean, what harm? It's not like he's going to get beaned or something.
Well, he's not going to get beaned. I guess the worry is that he might get hurt. But I like Bumgarner's reply. He said, they let me ride a horse during the World Series celebration. Why can't they let me try to hit a home run?
I would consider the first to be much more dangerous than the second.
So would I. The New York Mets acquired infielder Kelly Johnson on Wednesday, thus making Johnson the second player in Major League Baseball history to have been acquired by the same team in two consecutive seasons. They really do have a stat for everything in baseball. I can hear this guy talking to his grandchildren. Sure, Babe Ruth hit a lot of home runs, but did he ever get acquired by the same team in two consecutive seasons?
I'll tell you, somebody in the New York Mets front office really likes Kelly Johnson.
Charlie, this week, Maria Sharapova learned that she is banned from tennis for 2 years. She claims she didn't see the memo that banned Mildrenate, which she says she had been taking for health reasons rather than for tennis reasons. Is a 2-year ban a reasonable penalty for taking a substance for nearly a decade that wasn't on the banned list until last year?
No, it's ridiculous. This should be a fine and you can't play at the U.S. Open this year or something like that. It's ridiculous to declare what is essentially an ex post facto offense.
Beginning this season, NFL players will not be allowed to wear hoodies under their uniforms. I wonder who decided that that's where the focus of football's rulemakers should be.
Hey, listen, we just talked about how many sticks there are and how much mud in baseball. That pales against what it's like in the front office of the NFL.
The Ohio State University has decided to expand beer sales at football games there. The extra money generated by those sales will pay for two full-time police officers and a study on alcohol consumption and how its presence affects public events. So I guess the theory is you can't study something if you don't allow that something to happen and even encourage it by giving it a lot of beer.
Forgive me, but don't we already know what the impact of alcohol consumption at large public events are?
Yeah, there is a fair amount of evidence out there for anybody interested in reading it, but I love the idea that two police officers will be salaried. And
I'll tell you what, if they really do expand beer sales in Columbus, those two offices are going to be the most well-paid cops in the entire state of Ohio.
I'm not sure they're going to give them all the money. And finally, Charlie, I am all for anyone who tweaks the stuffed shirts or the sticks in the mud in the No Fun League, a.k.a. the NFL. But would you agree with me that perhaps whoever hacked the league's Twitter feed on Tuesday perhaps went a little too far?
Yeah, you shouldn't really be telling people that the commissioner is dead. And I'm sure Roger Goodell will find some way to blame the Patriots for it.
You can find the sports writing of Charlie Pierce at SI.com. And, of course, he joins me each week on Only a Game as well. Thanks, Charlie.
Thank you, Bill.
In the world of Mookies, which is best? That's what commentator Mike Pesca wants you to know.
A couple of weeks ago, 23-year-old Boston Red Sox outfielder Mookie Betts did something amazing. He hit three home runs in a single game. In fact, over the course of two games, really, over the course of seven at-bats, he hit five home runs. And this prodigious output was not an aberration. Mookie Betts has been impressing people and tearing up baseball for a couple of years now. I would go as far as to say that he's inviting comparisons to some of the all-time greats. Whoa, wait, Mike. Okay, the kid's got a little something, but the all-time greats? Oh, I don't mean the all-time great players. Don't put this guy in the Hall of Fame yet. I mean the all-time great Mookies. I am assembling the Mookie rankings. In fact, I call it the Mookieometer. Mookie meter, if you will. I've surveyed all the professional sports. There has never been a professional Mookie in football. No NFL Mookies. The NHL, likewise, devoid of Mookies. But there has been another Mookie in baseball and a Mookie in the NBA. The baseball Mookie, I bet you know, was Mookie Wilson. He's a famous guy. How famous? Well, he's a center fielder named Wilson who played during the 80s, hit leadoff, and won the World Series. So you immediately thought of Mookie Wilson, right? That also describes Willie Wilson. The fact that you thought of Mookie Wilson and not Willie Wilson could indicate that the name Mookie is an excellent brand. Well, Willie Wilson has an all-time WAR, which is the wins above replacement score, of 22. This means that over the course of his career, which was over 20 years, he was worth 22 more wins than just an average guy, a guy who could be called up from AAA or barely managed to make a major league roster. Right now, Mookie Betts' WAR, wins above replacement, which is cumulative, you could add to it every year, is 11. And at his current rate, Mookie Betts has an outside chance by the end of this year, and a likely chance by next year, to catch and pass Mookie Wilson as the all-time greatest baseball-playing Mookie. This will not, however, make him the greatest sports Mookie of all time, because this brings us to Mookie Blaylock. Mookie Blaylock of the NBA has a similar stat, a stat similar to WAR. It's called win shares, and his win shares are 72. I've done a lot of calculations, and I figured out a way to translate win shares into wins above replacement. I compared the greatest season in terms of each statistic. I compared the 100th best season in terms of each statistic. And if you multiply win shares, the basketball stats, by about 0.8, you get the equivalent of WAR, the baseball stat, which indicates that Mookie Betts has quite a few years to go before he becomes the greatest Mookie of all time. There are, of course, limits to even advanced statistics. It's very hard to compare these Mookies to Spike Lee's character Mookie in Do the Right Thing. And even though that Mookie had a good throwing arm, his projectile was a trash can. I have invented the Mookie meter. I have invented these Mookie rankings, but I want to invite you all to join with me as we assess the state of our current Mookie. So the Mookie rankings are my baby in a way, but Mookie, Mookie, it's your baby too, to quote Rosie Perez from Do the Right Thing. And I don't know if this current Mookie, Mookie Betts will wind up being the best Mookie ever, because you've got to think that eventually there'll be another Mookie rookie coming down the pike.
Mike Pesca hosts the daily podcast The Gist from Slate. He's a panelist on the sports podcast Hang Up and Listen, which posts every Monday. I first saw the U.S. women's soccer team play almost 25 years ago at Tufts University in Medford, Massachusetts. Their opponent was the Norwegian national team. I was there because a friend who knew some of the players told me my young daughters would enjoy the game. And they did, and so did I. And I learned that a year earlier, when those women had returned to the U.S. after winning the first Women's World Cup in 1991, they'd been greeted by exactly one reporter. The first women's pro soccer league emerged from the excitement of the 1999 Women's World Cup, which the U.S. women also won, at which point Brandi Chastain became a poster girl.
Second time the United States has won the Women's World Cup, and Brandi Chastain gets the game winner in the PK.
She was so cool.
That league was the Women's United Soccer Association, and it lasted from 2000 until 2003. It featured U.S. stars Mia Hamm, Christine Lilly, and Julie Foudy, as well as the best players from Japan, Germany, Norway, and the other nations in which women's soccer had made an impact. Toward the end of the 2003 season, I interviewed a young Boston Breakers defender named Kate Sobrero. When she'd answered my last question, she hugged me. I thought this was a little odd until a day or two later, when I learned what Kate had already known. The league was suspending operations. The WUSA was followed by women's professional soccer. The WPS began play in 2009 and ceased operations after the 2011 season. Both leagues provided excellent soccer, and the ticket prices delighted fathers, mothers, and coaches of soccer-playing children. Both leagues lacked national sponsors. Both ran out of money. Then along came the National Women's Soccer League.
Inside for Christine Nair and the hero on Wednesday. Back for Matheson on the left side. Devanna open in the middle. Matheson will play her. Devanna can't get on it. Garrett
the NWSL began play in 2013, and money was an object. A team salary cap ensures that nobody will get rich, and the national federations of the U.S., Mexico, and Canada help out by paying the salaries of their national team players on NWSL teams. When those national team players get called up for duty in a season that includes the Women's World Cup or the Olympics, well, that's where players like Allie Murphy and Cassidy Brown come in. Each had been playing on the reserve squad of an NWSL team, Murphy for the Washington Spirit, Brown for the Chicago Red Stars, and each recently learned she had a job.
I received an email late one Sunday afternoon on my phone, and I was pretty shocked.
That's Cassidy Brown.
I just was checking my email on a regular daily basis, and I read, congratulations, you've been called up to sign an amateur contract with Chicago Red Stars.
It was that amateur contract thing that intrigued me. I'd never heard of any professional team in any sport filling roster spots with amateurs, and neither had anybody else at only a game. Major League Baseball teams bring up players from the minors. NBA teams sometimes dip into the developmental league. The call-ups are pros. They may not be making much, but they're paid. But the women replacing the Olympians, here's Allie Murphy.
Well, basically, because we have amateur contracts and because we're not getting paid and on a regular contract, we're still considered we can play for the reserve team. But then when we get called up, we don't lose our amateur status.
Okay, well, then this is very confusing to me because you're an amateur in somebody's mind, but you're getting paid to play the game, so you're a professional too, right?
Yeah, but just for those exact games.
Do you know what the rate is per game?
I wouldn't know because, unfortunately, the one game I got called up actually got canceled.
So you won't actually know what the rate is until you see a paycheck, I guess?
Yeah, pretty much. Sadly, I'm in that boat.
Yeah, but not exactly sadly, because both Ally Murphy and Cassidy Brown, like Mia Hamm and Christine Lilly and Abby Wambach before them, have wanted to play soccer at this level since they were little girls. The invitation to become unpaid members of the reserve squads of their respective teams was a step toward accomplishing that, and now, at least temporarily, they are both in the pros, though there's apparently some confusion about what that means. Here's Cassidy Brown.
To my understanding, amateur means basically that I am able to play for the Chicago Red Stars, dress for games, but I'm not compensated any money.
So wait a minute. You're going to take the field for the Red Stars potentially, but you're not going to get paid?
Correct. When you put it that way, it sounds crazy, but yeah.
It also sounds as if, assuming Cassidy Brown is right, Ally Murphy is in for a nasty surprise when she opens up the envelope in her locker and finds a thank you note and no check. Women's pro soccer is so threadbare that two entertaining leagues have come and gone, and young women who recently starred on college teams find themselves in this ambiguous position. Are they pros? Sure, they've been added to a pro team's roster, but are they paid? Gee, they're not sure. Or at least one of them isn't. On the other hand, as the U.S. women's team warms up for Rio, the NWSL is still in business. If the business is kind of crazy, Cassidy Brown's word for it, at least the gates are still open. As Ally Murphy sees it, that's pretty much the whole point.
Soccer has really been my dream since, you know, I could walk and talk if you ask my parents. It's what I've always wanted to do. I actually am the baby on the team. I'm the youngest of everyone on the team, so I kind of want to see where it takes me and play for as long as I can. I'll probably be, you know, one of those old veteran players that are having to, like, force it into retirement just because I love the sport that much. And I think that love, I think, has to show with the fact that I am just an amateur call, but I just hope that one day it will be my time.
I began pursuing this story because I've enjoyed the women's pro soccer I've watched in Boston, in Washington, D.C., in Florida, and in Los Angeles, among other places, as the pro leagues have come and gone. I root for the pro game today, too, but I was curious about how anybody could be an amateur playing for a professional team. I guess I needed to be reminded that the root of amateur is the word that means to love. So, Ally Murphy and Cassidy Brown, thanks for the reminder, and may your time be now. Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Martin Kessler. Our technical director is Marquise Neal. We had help this week from Alex Schroeder and from Mike Garth. Our intern is Ian Foster, and our senior producer is Gary Wallen. Our final word comes from Muhammad Ali, who in 1971 recited an original poem on British television.
Now Ali lands to the right. What a beautiful swing. And the punchless Frazier clean out of the rain.
That's great, champ, but...
Now Frazier disappears from view. The crowd is getting frantic. But our radar station staff picked him up. He's somewhere over the Atlantic.
Far be it from me to interfere with the completion of some fine, fine doggerel. I'm Bill Littlefield. We return next week with more Sports NPR style on Only a Game, and thank you for listening.